can't tell if the chemistry's good by looking at it. It wasn't clear yesterday. For the last time, the saltwater pool is a chlorine pool.
This is the Talking Pools Podcast with pool pros from every region in the country. If it happens in a pool, you'll hear about it here. Everything from tips and hacks to the latest tricks and trends. Breaking news, we lay it on the line. We tell it like it is because we think you deserve to know.
Make your voice heard. Join the Council for the Model Aquatic Health Code. Lend your expertise to the MAC, science-based guidance from the CDC, and the only all-inclusive national pool code that addresses current aquatic issues. Learn more at cmac.org. That's cmahc.org.
And it's Kelly with Tuesdays with Dan and Kelly.
Or Tuesdays with Kelly and Dan. Depending on if you're dyslexic or not, I guess.
Hey, we have to remember this intro every time.
Yeah, right.
Only we pre-recorded right. It.
Hey, by the way, Happy New Year. I haven't done one of these with you since before the holidays. So
I know. Happy New Year. Has it been busy for you?
Yeah, busy. I just got back from a Latham conference. Was down there in Puerto Vallarta for a few days. And that's always a cool thing to do, get to be able to see people from all over the country. Somewhere around 900 or 1,000 people that they brought together.
Wow.
Literally booked this whole resort, took it over. So many people that their own Latham staff had to go down the street to do it. But it was good. It was learned some new things. They got some new things coming out this year that'll be helpful to the industry for people that use them and stuff like that. But just one of those things we do in the off season, right?
Yeah, I wish I can go to a tropical destination, you know, and be treated for spending lots of money someday, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, so. I've been busy because of the rain. What was it? The news said we've had 10 storms since New Year's Day, trees everywhere down. And it's not like it's a little amount of rain, like it's pouring. So it's not like you can get a lot. Went on Thursday, got as much as I could done because it was sunny. And then Friday, they're like, oh, it's going to rain. I'm like, okay, well, I'll just, a lot of times when they say it's going to rain, it doesn't rain until later. So yeah. I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to work until it pours.
Yeah.
Well, luckily, the maintenance guy at the property gave me one of their umbrellas that they use to keep the tenants, you know, cut shaded. Mm-hmm. So I got about 3 hours of plumbing done with that.
Oh, that's
umbrella.
Good. Yeah.
And then I was like, yep, I'm out. I'm going home.
Yep. You know, we have those, like, I'm going to say easy up or whatever you call them, mm-hmm. pop-up canopy things that a lot of our guys carry them on the trucks, those that make the room for them and that just because of that.
I do that in the summertime. Yeah. I was nervous bringing it with me because I didn't know how windy it was going to be because it's about a half hour drive from where I live.
Okay.
And it wasn't windy. It was windy at my house, but it wasn't windy there.
We also, this past year, we picked up golf umbrellas that, you know, they're, I think they're made to go. I'm not a golfer, but I think they're made to go onto the golf bag cart, you know, mm-hmm. they're really big, and the guys will pop those open and just have them sit on the ground.
Yep.
And it kind of makes like a half shell around them or whatever up against the house where the equipment is and things, you know, you got a little bit of an eave overhang that the rain's not coming straight down if you're within a couple of feet, and then that helps keep it off of your plumbing and everything else that you're working on. So, and they don't take up as much space in the truck too as those pop-up things, the big metal frames and all that kind of stuff.
I have a smaller umbrella. It works when I use it, but it has a clip so I can clip it on something.
Mm-hmm.
And that saved me a lot of times from the sun, because once that sun hit, or if I forget, I know it's kind of, you know, hobo-ish, but I'll tear apart the box and shade for myself. Like,
yeah.
Hey, whatever I got to do to finish the job.
Yeah. You know, I've seen guys take the cardboard box and cut a hole in it that it sits on top of their baseball hat or their, the hats that they wear to keep the sun off of them and make it bigger to keep the face dry from the rain that's falling and stuff like that. You get creative when you need to get something done and you're losing time. And this sounds like right now by you or at least recently by you, it's been nothing but rain.
So today we were going to answer a couple questions that we received from listeners. And the first question was, what do we do with buckets and motors and all those spare parts that collect in your garage or your graveyard, as people call it?
Yeah.
I think my buckets I give away to like sports. So like Little League and stuff, so they can make little
softball and Little League and all that kind of stuff for carrying the balls. And
yeah, so we just give buckets away to whoever wants them. I've also rinsed them out really, really good and turned them into planters for my tomatoes.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Oh, it worked. I did it 2 years ago. It worked great. Drill some holes at the bottom.
We reuse them for a lot of things internally. Most of what we do is that we triple rinse all of them before we do anything else with them. But in our market, there are some pools, not many left out there, but there are still some pools out there that are painted and they are great for mixing epoxy paint in and using them for that. Mostly though, a lot of the guys will use them for pipe fittings and transporting pipe fittings to the backyard and such from, the trucks are all equipped with bins and so forth. But when you go out and you see what you need and you're like, all right, I need a couple elbows, a couple male adapters, a couple of couplings, and you take a 5 gallon bucket and you throw it all in there and go out to the backyard to cut the number of trips.
They're really good for sand filters when you want to change the sand out or you're replacing a whole sand filter, cut it open, put it into those buckets.
Yep.
Obviously don't fill them completely, but that helps out a lot.
Yep. We also use them when we're building or, doing liner replacements and things where we've got water issues in the ground, and we'll drill holes into them and put a sump pump inside of it so the pump doesn't get the muck and the mud and all that kind of stuff washing into it and clogging it up. The water will go in, but the stuff will stay out. But I know a lot of people, too, that they run into buckets and they just put them on the street with a sign that says free.
Oh, yeah. And people take them. No problem.
Yeah. Everyone's always looking for buckets. I have, more than my wife would want me to admit in my shed right now. She's like, why don't you get rid of those things? I'm like, no, they're good buckets. I'm not getting rid of them.
Buckets, anybody can use them. If you don't want them, anyone will take them probably.
Yeah, they make great stools when you're, instead of being on your knees and bending over all day when you're plumbing the equipment and stuff, sometimes you can just drop one down there and sit on it.
Now, if you reuse them to carry chemicals in your truck, make sure to spray paint them so that their labeling is not showed. Because if you were to get into, and CHP told me this at an IPSA meeting, because if you were to get in a car accident, even though you put bicarb in this bucket, they're going by what it's labeled, not by what you're saying's in it. Now, if you have it spray painted and they can't see the labels, just make sure you have the SD sheet.
Yeah.
So that,
SDS sheet. Yeah.
Yeah. SDS sheet. And do it that way.
Yeah. We don't do anything like that with chemicals in them. I'm not a fan myself of that because of that particular thing. It's easy to control when it's you. But with a staff and everything else, I'm always worried. So my blanket rule is that that's not something people can do because I'm afraid they'll put something in a bucket. It won't be labeled right. And next thing you know, we've got issues if something happens. But that's all relative, I think, to, certainly you doing it on your own. You got the ability of knowing you're going to be doing it, protecting things and so forth, where we don't always have all of that confidence sometimes.
You have the pool drained, but you're rinsing down the sides and the floor, but you need to pump this water out so you can continue that process. You can do that. Take one of those buckets, make some holes in it, and put the submersible pump inside. That way you can keep the bigger debris out instead of it clogging the impeller, you know, 50 right. million times.
Yeah, helps to strain it away. It's like a pump basket in reverse, sort of. So that's yeah, for buckets, they're always different. You know, I saw something just the other day. Jeff Hampe, who I know a lot of people know from the industry, used them to be the anchors for a tent that he constructed to keep the sun yeah. off of them. He put piece of looked like 2-inch PVC in the bucket on an angle from one the bottom of one side up to the top of the other, and filled it with concrete, and had a dozen of these things around the pool, slid, looked like maybe 1-inch or 3/4-inch PVC inside of it, and fashioned the framework for a tent over yeah. the top of the pool. And I was like, well, that's genius. Just another good use for them. And then once you have it, you know, maybe that's something you find a place to keep it. So next time you need it, you just take it out to a job site instead of going through more bags of concrete and everything else. But
right. That was, totally I understand that was though, the whole thing where people are like, what the hell do I do with all of these? Because yeah. they do add up. They can add up. I probably have about 50 in my backyard. Yeah. But there are multiple ways that you can at least use the buckets, no matter what the sizes are.
Right. Right.
Now, when it comes to motors.
Yeah, I was going to say motors. That's a little different story. We do let our employees that want to do the scrapping of stuff take that and scrap it on their own. Mm-hmm. You know, so a motor, there's a lot of copper in that. And
especially if you get the old pumps, like yeah. I did a couple of weeks ago, where the front end is made out of brass.
Oh, geez. Yeah. That's got a lot of value to it.
This thing's super heavy taking out to the truck. Part of me is like, do I really want to do this? But hey, that's like $100 right there.
Yeah. Copper heat exchangers, of course. I think most of us know that. But yeah, there's a lot of brass and bronze in our industry if you pay attention to it. And I know a lot of people that'll just find a place to store that during the season. And at some point when it's a little slower, they'll strip it down as much as they need to and take the junk to the landfill or the whatever and then take the scrap to the places and you know, you get hundreds of dollars at the end of the year or more by doing that. But
my dad, he used to do that every single year. We had the graveyard in the backyard back in the 90s. Yeah. Obviously, that was a lot more weight back then. But he stopped doing it a couple years ago. He's like, the amount of time it takes me to take apart these motors and scrap it wasn't worth it for him. Mm-hmm. But hey, if you need a little extra money, you know,
right.
it's worth it.
And that's where it is for us as a business. It's not worth us to pay somebody to go through tearing it apart to scrap the metal. And, you know, if you know, heat exchangers, the last couple of years were the copper in those. It was a decent amount of money per unit that the guys were getting. So they would keep it in the back of their truck or, you know, their personal truck or, you know, a lot of them are driving pickup trucks. So you'd see after, you know, the month of May, which tends to be our biggest equipment replacement month.
May, you know, last year for me was my biggest equipment
month. Yeah. Yeah. You see a few heat exchangers and a handful of motors and some brass, this and that laying in the back of the truck that, you know, is going to pay for a Memorial Day party or something.
Yep.
So motors, heat exchangers, gosh, what else we deal with? Filter tanks or something that I've seen people use them for. Coolers.
Expecting 50 million things, you know.
Right. But, you know, during the heat of the COVID years when the shortages were such a huge problem and getting parts yeah. was next to impossible, we actually did implement a policy at those times that we weren't allowing the employees to scrap stuff, heaters that came back. You know, if the heat exchanger is shot and leaking, that's fine. But we did save those because of the potential of needing the parts that weren't a problem.
Yeah, the drive was still good, but the rest, there was a leak in the pump and you couldn't fix right. it. Okay, I'm going to keep that drive just in case I need it in the right. near future.
You know, if it's something that'll get some customer's yeah. pool up and running when otherwise you just can't get something. Yeah, so it was a unique series of years that we're hopefully coming out of now that you kind of had to MacGyver any way you could to get stuff to go. And that's one thing we did. We kept pumps, the plastic, the wet ends, we kept the motors, they could unbolt them, take the motor. That's fine. But we'd keep the wet ends. The heaters, if it was, like a Ray Pack or an older Telline Lars or something, then we'd let them take the exchanger because the rest of the unit is not really compromised when you do that. But if it was a newer style, like a Master Temp Pentair heater or the new Jandy style, and now even Ray Pack has one too. Hayward, I think they've got their same. It, when you tear those things down to get the exchanger out, the thing is really left in shambles. And the guy tearing the exchanger out of those doesn't, he's not careful about protecting everything else, disassembling it carefully and that. So I said, you know what, let's just get those put off to the side. And we know the exchangers are bad, and we will see if we need any of the other stuff out of them as time goes by. So, but that, hopefully that's all behind us. And after this year, I can open those up to the guys have their names on them. So we know who has rights to them when the time comes to scrap whatever they can get out of them. But out of necessity, we had to kind of change the rules a little bit for a couple of years.
Yeah, there's lots of things you can do with those things. It's just a matter of what storage you have and where you can keep it.
Yeah, and then remembering what you got, if you're going to try to use it somewhere else to help someone out or however you're going to use it in your business, to know that you've got it. If there is downtime, like in our market, we have, a few months in winter downtime. Maybe it's worth taking it apart and just making a spreadsheet or even a note. Pad list of what you got so you can refer back without having to when you're out on a job site go, I wonder is that still out there? Did I use that? If you know that it's there at the house or at the shop or whatever, and you can pick it up and come back out the next day or something, that kind of helps you streamline what you're doing. And if anyone has any other ideas that we haven't touched on these things, go ahead and post them in the comments under this at the Talking Pools Facebook page and let us know what you guys are doing with all of these extra things. How are you making good use of them, or how are you just getting rid of them? What's the most effective way to do that? Sometimes people are can stockpile it up enough to take it to a landfill, and usually that's pretty inexpensive to take a pickup truck load or a trailer load to a landfill, as opposed to putting it in a dumpster or something like that where it costs more to get it hauled out.
So I'm very fortunate that I have a dad with a dumpster, so that I don't have to worry too much about that kind of stuff, like the costs. So yeah. If I have a heater or something, they pick up appliances twice a week.
Yep.
So I put that there. For warranties, I have to hold on to all things I warranty for 30 days.
Yeah.
That's a pain in my butt because they usually hang out in my garage a lot longer.
Yeah, and sure.
Then I just toss what I don't need. Like, honestly, I'll take parts off of those things once they don't want it back.
Kelly and Dan will be right back after these messages.
Have you heard there is a group of pool service professionals nationwide that are here to help grow and protect your business? The Independent Pool and Spa Service Association, known as IPSA, is here to help you. By joining the largest trade organization created by and for pool and spa service techs, you gain access to industry networking opportunities, exclusive educational offerings, IPSA's Tech for Tech route coverage, and more. So be independent, supported, and part of a professional community. Go to IPSSA.com to learn how to be a member of IPSA today.
So the other question we had was about how CO2 can help with bringing pH down.
So CO2, that is, what is that? Carrots, oranges, and carbon dioxide. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So what is...
It's in the air, and it definitely... So when we're using carbon dioxide to control pH... What are we doing? How are we doing that? We just go buy a box of it and dump it in? Is that
so? You can add dry acid, is it dry acid? The stuff that you buy for Halloween to make it all smoky?
Dry ice.
Dry ice, yes.
There you go, because that gives off carbon dioxide. Yep. Throw that in the pool.
You can add to a pool, or you can get a CO2 tank and have automation that will inject it into the water for you.
Right.
Now, so with carbon or we'll just say CO2 because carbon dioxide sounds kind of morbid to me. So with CO2, it is in the air, as we all know, because of us breathing and, you know, plants, they love it. Sorry, I refer to plants. I'm a plant lady lately. But the more CO2 you have in the water, the more the pH will go down. The more CO2 in the air, the more the pH will go up. They say that CO2 will make it, if you don't have it in the water, it will make it so your pH will kind of level out at 8.4. Now, if you were to add too much CO2 to your pool, it will drop all the way down to a 5. And obviously, we want our goal to be between 7.2 and 7.8. Now, when you add muriatic acid to water, it creates a form of carbon dioxide, and that's why the pH goes down. When you do add CO2 to water, it forms a Aquenous. Aquenous CO2?
Aquenous.
Aquenous.
I believe that's the correct.
And I have to call it that because that's what it is. So aqueous CO2. And when you add it to the water, only a small percentage will form carbon acid, which is what the CO2 turns into with water.
Yeah.
And carbonic
acid.
Carbonic acid. I'm not a scientist. I'm still learning. I'm sorry, Rudy. I know that you'll be on me about saying it correctly. But when you do it that way, it lowers the pH slightly. And what we're trying to do is we're having a balance between CO2 in the water and CO2 in the air. And that's why if you have more in the air than you do the water, your pH will go up to about 8.4. CO2 does, though, need to be constantly fed since it will gas off. So that's where, if you want to use CO2, you really need to have the ejection system so that it does little bits as needed, kind of like when you have a automation system that does ORP and pH. When your pH is not where your guidelines are, it adds acid for X amount of time. Right. With CO2, like I said, because it gas off, you need to constantly have that monitored. So you adding dry ice may not be the best idea because you're going to have to do it all day long. Now, if you do add too much CO2 to your pool, and if you use too little, it will knock everything out of balance chemically. And you can damage the pool, the rails, everything that we can damage from just having, you know, poorly balanced water. Now.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that carbon dioxide is, you probably have never experienced a pool that had gas chlorine to chlorine it.
No, I'm too young.
Right. So I'm not too young. And I remember distinctly all, too often issues of people who weren't familiar with how to change the tanks, didn't replace the lead washers, and chlorine gas would escape, and we'd have neighborhoods evacuated around community pools and all kinds of crazy bad things. Certainly not that you want to be breathing direct carbon, dioxide in a room if it's filled with it, but gas chlorine is extremely dangerous, and I'm very glad that it's really not used in our industry anymore today. But carbon dioxide is used in a similar way, like you were saying, the tanks and feeders that inject it into the system. And carbon dioxide is much less concerning in terms of that safety that the gas chlorine used to have over the years with I remember many times around the Chicagoland area hearing or experiencing pools where they had just the maintenance man who was fixing the plumbing under the sink the day before go out and change the gas chlorine tank and not get it seeded properly and very quickly, all of a sudden the whole neighborhood would be evacuated because of the chlorine gas. Carbon dioxide isn't quite that way. Not that you don't want to be careful with it and make sure that you're doing things properly, but it's a safe way to lower pH. It doesn't have an effect on alkalinity.
Actually, it does.
Well, it has a reverse effect, truly. If anything, it'll cause the alkalinity to rise a little bit, which is interesting. But where muriatic acid inevitably is going to affect both pH and alkalinity, carbon dioxide is really going after pH.
When you have these CO2 systems and you're going to see a rise in your alkalinity. Obviously, we wouldn't be using the CO2 system if it was increasing it, you know, significantly quickly. So periodically, yeah, you're going to have to add muriatic acid to get the alkalinity down. So you'll want it. You want your targets to probably be on the lower end of the spectrum of alkalinity, so it has time to go up.
Yep.
But turn your CO2 sensors and everything off when you do that until you get your alkaline where you want, instead of it just constantly fighting.
Yeah, that's no different than a conventional acid feeder. You're never going to add an increaser to a pool and leave the acid feeder online when you're doing it, because it's just going to start pumping acid when it senses the reaction of that increaser that you've put in the water. So same kind of thing goes with carbon dioxide. If you're treating the alkalinity, it's a good idea to let that reaction occur and then put your CO2 back online after.
Now, another thing, if you are using Calhypo on your pool, don't do a CO2 system, because you're going to be fighting that calcium pH every time you put that Calhypo in there, and that can make it so it's not as effective. So muriatic acid is going to be the better option in that situation, where you're using chlorine that's stabilized by something with a high pH. But if you're using like liquid chlorine, using CO2 as the way to balance out your pH is probably going to be a lot cheaper and effective. You're not going to have the risk of, accidentally mixing your chlorine and your acid. And, it's also becomes greenhouse effective. So like you reduce your greenhouse emissions by using CO2 compared to using muriatic acid. So yes, right. Us crazies in California, where we care about our planet, it's a way of going green.
Well, and plants love carbon dioxide, right? And you being a plant lady, I know you're growing green beans and lettuce and stuff behind
and
you there in your podcast studio. But
I had to take my light off because my son wanted to play with it, and I thought that'd be too distracting.
The people always say talk to your plants and your plants will respond, and that's because when you exhale, you give off carbon dioxide, which the plants love to take in. So before I saw you back there reading a book to your green bean plants before we started this, and that's great that you care for them so well. But you could skip that a little bit.
I play nice classical music.
They're going to be very well-rounded green beans. But anyway, the CO2 is, I guess that's another way you could get CO2 in the pool, right? Just sit and talk to your pool. Probably not.
No. Now, let's say you add too much CO2 to your pool. A way to counter it is aeration. So turn your jets on, turn your water features on, any way that you can aerate that water.
Get the oxygen back in, right?
Yep.
It'll displace that essentially and cause the reversal of what's going on with it. That's not always an easy way of doing things. Not every pool has the ability of aeration and so forth,
right.
But it is an option as opposed to throwing more chemicals at it to counter it.
Now, you don't usually see these CO2 systems on residential pools. You're going to see these more in the commercial field. I know my dad's, he does a lot of repairs in commercial and he puts them in all the time, and I'm starting to put them in. Now, one question I had for a while was, how do you dose this? Like, I know when I go to a commercial pool that's chlorine and acid, I have to go on the feeder Jesus. I have to go on the feeders, you know, and say what run times I want, what, you know, my parameters are. Mm-hmm. And so with the best way for me to explain it was kind of giving you a scenario. So if you have an alkalinity of 110 and you want to go from 7.8 to 7.5 for your pH, with muriatic acid, you would put 26 ounces. Now, with CO2 low, if you wanted to do that, you would need to use 0.79 pounds of CO2. So for every 26 ounces, you need 3/4 of a pound of CO2 in order to reduce that pH level.
Cool. Look at you being all scientific and shit.
I know, I'm trying.
Wow.
If I'm going to talk about something, I'm going to try to actually teach you something.
That's awesome.
Completely out of my.
That's actually very, very cool to know. I did not know that. But we don't see CO2 even in commercial applications around us. Almost never in the Chicago market. It is there, but almost never.
So here where I'm at, it's going to be on those larger pools. So like the one in Truckee where the, you know, this is like 100,000-gallon pool. They're putting CO2 tanks on it because it's going to control the water better for them, and it's going to be safer for the people who are in it. Doesn't mean that if you're using muriatic acid, your pool's not safe. It's just, you know, it's a different application for everything, you know. And when you have these pools that are far away and large, you try to make it so that you're not having too many, you know, risks. So like another like great thing about like a benefit of having this type of system, a CO2 system, is you're going to see, compared to using muriatic acid, you're going to see more gradual, more effective, more precise measurements using CO2, because it's not like you have it run for 30 seconds and then time out for an hour. You're doing little tiny, like smaller increments than you would with muriatic acid. So it's more precise and you're using less. Also, you are the chloramines. You're going to reduce the chloramines that are even being generated compared to a muriatic acid system. So there are a lot of benefits to using it. I was asking my dad, like, what does, you know, a tank cost? And he's like, a 20-pound tank costs like $20, I think he said. Something really cheap. Or it's like a 40-pound tank was like $20, and it lasts 2 to 3 months. So the cost alone, hey, I just bought acid a week ago.
Yeah.
I was ready to like quit my job.
Right.
Because for me in Northern California, it was what, $35 for a case of acid?
For a case, yeah.
I remember it was $16.
Yep. Yep. Acid and well, like everything else, it's getting crazy. Acid, chlorine.
Keep in mind, people, these control systems that can control CO2 are not cheap. So there is a large upfront cost. You do need to maintain it. You need to make sure the injectors are working properly, because if they aren't, if for some reason something is just not, you know, up to par, you know, maybe you need an injector replaced or something's just not working at 100%, it's not going to be as effective and you are going to use more CO2. But that's how it is also with a chlorine feeder, acid feeder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just got to make sure you regularly change tubes, the injectors, like every single aspect of it, so that it's working in tip-top shape. And then some of these, you have the tank directly going into the tube, and they have a regulator on the tank so it doesn't, you know, shoot out too much. But then in some applications, they have a large mixing tank where they inject the CO2 into the water of the mixing tank and then send it out. So there's also those different applications as well.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a company that actually makes a salt system for a pool that's similar to that,
mm-hmm.
where the chlorine and the salt Well, the salt never ends up in the pool. So it's like a brine tank, if you will, that the chlorine is produced within. And then the chlorine itself is what gets sent out in the pool. So a little bit different scenario from the conventional salt systems. But yeah, the aspect of the mixing chamber. You know, ozone has the same type of thing available. Almost all ozone manufacturers have mixing chambers for those as well. Mm-hmm. So that you can get that ozone to mix in the mechanical room instead of out in the pool water and get it to do its job outside of there. So that's great stuff. I like it.
Hopefully it was helpful. I learned a lot.
Yeah. Carbon dioxide killing.
But I felt like I needed to know this since the same company my dad works for, I do repairs for, and they're starting to ask if I can start installing those. Cool. And I don't want to be, I'm not the type of person where you ask me to install, just like, sure, and not know anything about it.
Yep.
You know, how, if I install this, how do I know how to program it to at least start somewhere?
Right. Yep. Good stuff. Good questions, too.
I know. I love when we get viewer questions. Can we please get more?
More. We need more questions. I'll start sending anonymous questions.
Let's see what Billy comes up with on these questions of the week.
I have a problem with this one alligator getting in my pool every Sunday when I want to swim. What should I do about it?
Hire
not
a
in Chicago. So,
oh my God.
Well, how about that? That's like a whole episode on listener questions.
That's awesome. Hey, awesome. I like it because then I know that the listeners are going to listen.
That's, you know what? And you did a great job researching CO2. I'm going to reach through this podcast mic and pat you on the back. So
dealing with a three-year-old that I feel
at like, the same time, like that's a,
sugar
you're,
high.
You're amazing. Just amazing. Oh my God. So, well, thanks for that, Kelly. Appreciate all the research and stuff you did for all of us. So if anyone else has anything to add to that, again, find us in Talking Pools group on Facebook and throw some comments underneath if you have something else that you want to
add or tidbits of information on what can help us with dosing.
Yep. Or if you have other questions and you want to reach out, talkingpools@gmail.com. You can always send us emails there to ask questions or give us your insights too. None of us know everything, no matter what we do and all the rest of it we learn from one another. So.
And we're always learning something every day.
We are.
I went and helped somebody today because they said their pump, they couldn't figure out how to program the pump after someone pushed the emergency shutoff. Oh. And I'm like, okay, I'll come over and I'll show you. And he's like, okay. And I get there. I'm like, there's not a programming error. You guys didn't put a check valve on the pump. And it was another one of those pump situations where they're sharing.
Multiple pumps. Yeah.
I'm like, it's
like
nothing
that.
You did wrong. It's just, well, technically you did something wrong because you didn't put the check valve. But
yeah.
So, well, again, thank you guys for the questions. Please give us more. You can come up with whatever you think will catch us where we can't answer it, and we'll try answering it.
That would be great. We would love that. I love not answering questions.
I mean,
not knowing the answer to a question. I didn't say that right.
And then next week, which I believe is when this episode is going to air, you're going to be in Atlantic City.
I am. I'll be in Atlantic City for the NESPA show, which if anyone in the industry ever has an opportunity to go to Atlantic City, I know it's not the sand and the beach and the warmth and the waves of a lot of places in the middle of January or the end of January, but that show is one of the best educational opportunities that service people especially can find in the country. I've been going to it for a number of years, and this year we're bringing a number of our employees with, you know, we kind of started doing this a handful of years ago pre-COVID, taking them to New Orleans when the expo was out there, and then to Dallas last year, and decided this year that we're taking them to Atlantic City instead. I think we got 15 or 18 people that are going to be going out there.
Oh, that's
with,
fun.
Days loaded up with all kinds of stuff. And they're excited about it. And you know, think about that, Atlantic City in January, right?
Yeah.
Like that's, but they're excited about it because of the education opportunities. After being at the expo a couple of years and then seeing what NESPA had to offer, they were just amazed and thrilled, and I'm really looking forward to what they come back with, and hoping that they'll be able to share that with the rest of our staff and keep growing the education end of our business too. So,
well, yep, I can't wait to hear about how it was and the new things that you might have seen while you're there.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then there's the show in February, the beginning of February, where Heather's going to be there. She's doing a talking thing on business.
Is that the Florida show, Everything Under the Sun?
No.
Is it that one?
No, this one's in Houston. I think it's a Southwest show.
Southwest show. It's another good show. Everything Under the Sun is another good show. Mm-hmm. You know, these shows that are a little bit smaller regional things, I think, do really, really good stuff with education.
And so take advantage of, you know, the Southwest show, the Everything Under the Sun. And then in March, the 23rd through the 25th is the Western show, and I will be at that one.
Awesome.
So, there's almost somebody at all of the shows, because I know Andrea said she's going to try and go to the one in Florida. So just keep a lookout for us. We do have bright yellow shirts now, so you can see us in the crowd.
We do.
So
Talking Pools. We're there. We're everywhere.
Well, everybody have a good week, and I hope that you stay safe and busy, and we will talk to you soon.
Take care, everyone. Be safe.
I just wanted to take a minute to say thank you for listening today. I'm hoping you enjoyed the episode as much as we enjoyed putting it together for you. Listen, it's been a couple of wacky, crazy, screwed up years from pandemic to Poolmageddon. I just want you to know that we are all in this together. If there's anything that we can do for you, send me an email at talkingpools@gmail.com. Again, that's talkingpools@gmail.com. We're here. This is your podcast. We are the Pool People's Podcast, of the Pool People, for the Pool People, by the Pool People's Podcast. This one is about you. So thank you for tuning in and listening. Do me a favor, click subscribe before you go. That way you don't miss an episode.